Okay, so I am here with Adam Del Dio, who is one of the directors for Every Little Step. Adam, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thanks for having me.
First off, since Jim Stern is not here, I should point out that he has more experience on Broadway than you do, and I'm curious how the two of you split up your directorial duties. Do you feel that your comparative outsider's perspective actually aided the film? How did you work together? Did you arrive at consensus, or was there acrimony? What happened here?
Yeah, this is the third time Jim and I have worked together as co-directors on a film, and as you said, does myself in this instance being an outsider help the process? And we really do believe it did. Jim has produced many shows on Broadway, about 16, I believe. I've produced none, and although I was familiar with the chorus line, trying to find the right balance of a show that people that were very, very intimate with the original chorus line, the play, that knew it in and out, that they would love the film, and those that had never heard of it or heard very little of it, that they could enjoy the film as well. And I think, hopefully audiences will feel that was the case. That's what we were striving for. And we had many a debate in the edit room as to whether we were hitting that perfect synthesis.
Debate? What was the synthesis here?
Well, the obvious one was Jim being an insider did some of the more historical, specific, anecdotal information about the creation of the show. With that, how much of that should we use versus following a contemporary audition process of a revival? Mm-hmm. Was the show about more of the creation or more of auditioning? And we tried to weave those two together, and ultimately it did become more about the audition process. But we were very strategically and tactically tried to weave in moments of interviews with the original creators, Marvin Hamlisch, Bayork Lee, Bob Avian, Donna McKechnie, all these people that were part of the phenomenon, the tsunami of the original chorus line from 1975.
Gotcha. Well, you received unprecedented, supposedly, backstage access to shoot behind the scenes. I'm wondering if there were any particular conditions that had been established in terms of places you couldn't go, whether there were particular candidates for the jobs who took you aside and said, hey, I would appreciate that if you didn't put this into the film, or if there was any, I guess, prohibitions, I suppose, towards what you were able to shoot, or any sort of understandings. I'm curious.
Yeah, you're right in that it was unprecedented. Actors Equity had never allowed this. John Braulio, opened a dialogue with them. He's our executive producer, to go in and shoot the process. And then we had to make Equity comfortable with Jim and I, which happened. And in terms of prohibitions, I can't recall specifically. I mean, just generally, we tried to keep the cameras as kind of out of the way as possible and non-invasive as possible. In terms of performers wanting to participate in our documentary, they had the right to sign a release and participate or not. 99.9% of the people did.
Yeah.
And we're very thankful for that. And we just use good common sense. If someone had a bad audition, they're not feeling good, you might not want to storm them and want to interview them right on the spot, or, you just didn't want to make it a abrasive situation. And, by and large, our field producers and our cameramen, everyone's well-trained, and they know what they're doing, and it worked out just fine.
But you talk about abrasive moments and the 0.1% who didn't actually say yes. Mm-hmm. Do you think that as a documentary filmmaker, shouldn't you have a responsibility to try to capture as much of even the uncomfortable truths? And you do capture a number of them in the film, but I'm curious about this kind of self-prohibition that you've almost placed on shooting the film, mm-hmm. as opposed to, getting the complete picture of the story of this tremendous, protracted casting process.
Well, I think we absolutely got the complete picture, 100%. Like I said, the choice was if certain specific individuals didn't want to participate. Now, if those specific individuals had very difficult moments, I can't remember. There was thousands and thousands dancers coming in. But if someone doesn't want to participate in a documentary and doesn't want to be seen on film, that's the law. Every documentarian has to deal with that reality. So, you know, I just don't believe it had any bearing on the outcome of the film whatsoever.
Okay. The film revolves a lot around this compulsive need to perform at all costs. Yuka, we learn, for example, is right at the end of her rope. She's running out of unemployment. And so many of the dancers desperately need this gig. There's a certain meta quality to all this because, of course, it's a chorus line. I'm curious about whether this thematic emphasis was planned from the start or whether you stumbled into it. And if you did, in fact, stumble into it, did you gradually try to focus in on many of these high and low points of this need to perform and this tendency to actually get the gig or to even come close to getting the gig?
That's a great question. You know, we didn't, you know, a lot of it that unfolded was very natural and organic. It was just, and we knew we were going to have these moments. I mean, just the world of being a dancer, performer on Broadway, that there's an embedded struggle that comes along with that. if a dancer is to get hired on Broadway for a job, by and large, they're not making that much money. Yeah. And that in itself can be difficult. But to not be working and making a good paycheck and then still having this compulsive need to perform, you know, that desire where you have to go out, you have to sing, you have to dance to feel that your life is meaningful and that there's definition into what you're, you know, doing on this planet. And then juxtaposing that against the reality of not having any money and, you know, as you said, in Yuka's case, your unemployment's running out and things are getting scary. I mean, there's just, for us, it's very real and it's very dramatic and, you know, our hearts kind of, you know, you get really, you know, it's a human instinct to be very kind of moved by that type of drive. And, you know, these performers, they do, they go out every day and audition and work on their craft because they love it. That's the reason they do it.
Yeah.
You know, it's really summed up pointedly in the song What I Did for Love. That's the world they're in. But for them, there's no other option.
How hard or close did you keep tabs on all the prospective cast members? Because you have a lot of things, such as the Yuka unemployment thing. What vigorous duties did you place when trying to manage all the various stories in this and also covering everybody and having the camera there at specific key moments in their particular life that you can anticipate?
Yeah, we were very on top of it. We had a, you know, an extensive field production team with many cameras and we were, you know, as the process moves on, it winnows down. And so you eventually come up with 2 to 3 people coming for this final role. And so, you know, the shooting intensifies and things become more intimate and, you know, things happen. But, you know, our motto is just shoot as much as you can, shoot questions. As Jim likes to say, shoot first and ask questions later.
Yeah.
Make sure you just get it. You know, you never know what people are going to say and what's going to happen. You know, it's cinema verite, and that's the beauty of it. But, you know, you got to really be filming as much as possible. And, you know, that's why we had over 400 hours of footage.
Yeah, got it. There's a sentiment expressed from the production team in relation to casting. You've got to like them right away. And then you also have director Bob Avion saying the secret understanding Val is that she has a truck driver's mouth, but she's really a sweetheart. But I'm wondering if there is a point in any successful revival in which being liked or even being a sweetheart is possibly an artistic liability, and to what end were you, do you feel that you were able to capture this ethical question?
Yeah, I think it depends on the role that they're trying out for. I mean, I think in general, being a likable person, having kind of a natural feel and texture to yourself as being likable. Overall, I think that, and this is just my view, that helps you on Broadway. But, you know, a role like Sheila, for instance, in the play where there's abrasiveness to her, you know, maybe not being a completely likable person, maybe that helps you. I just think it's just dependent upon, you know, the roles one is going for in a show. I mean, Bob Avion said, you know, he said this many a times, if you don't get the job, it's not a statement on who you are. you know, there's very specific defined characters we're looking to cast in these roles, and you just may not be the right fit for it.
Yeah. I also want to offer an observation, one moment in which Yuka, who was up for Connie, reveals that she was born in Japan, and the production team expresses some concerns because she can't, in their view, possibly nail the right dialect because she wasn't born in the States. In fact, Bjork Lee says there's something about being born in America and fighting for a seat on the F train. Seeing as how Yuka did, in fact, get the part, this is interesting to me because if you were to take such a judgment and put it into another occupation, it would be discrimination. Mm-hmm. So I am curious about, you know, if an actor has the chops, should not they be able to essentially get the part irrespective of their background? This is one of the interesting things I think about the film, in which you see such a blunt judgment, despite the fact that it's done in all love, laid down on the table like that. So what of this dilemma?
Yeah, I think that it's an interesting observation. I think you're right. Whoever is right for the role and best for the role should get the role. But casting roles is very, very subjective. It's not... there's not a specific set of standards and information. I mean, what Bjork is seeing and what Bob Avian is seeing, they're seeing that differently. I mean, that part of the film is to me one of the most fascinating parts of the film, because Bjork is looking at Yuka. She knows she created that role.
Yeah.
Bjork Lee was taped by Michael Bennett, and that narrative created the role of Connie. She also happens to be the choreographer for the revival now, over 30 years later, and she's casting the character of Connie, which is her. And so, you know, she says to Bob Avian, "Well, you know, I think, you know, I don't see myself that cute." You know, and Bob's saying, "Well, she's very likable," and she's like, "Well, it's me." And so that was very interesting, but it's so subjective, and you know, there's a debate that a good healthy debate that happened between the creative team as to who was going to play what role, and I think it's part of the process.
But do you think, though, that such judgment almost crosses the line to some degree? Because she does, like I say, she gets cast in the part, she does a great job, you know, and so it could just be one of those things that Bjork just like kind of let off because they're all excited about casting the right role. But nevertheless, I say to myself, well, this is very interesting because if this is a judgment and these people are true professionals, imagine what all the other shows are like. And so I'm not sure if it's entirely fair if the actor has the chops.
Yeah, I think she got the role.
Yeah.
I mean, Bjork was, she had questions about that. They ultimately all decided she was best for it, correct?
Yes.
But... she maybe wasn't on board right away with that decision. She wanted to express her desire possibly to cast someone else. I think she talks about Jay Lane. She says, "I really liked her for the role." And that was her opinion, but it didn't happen. It wasn't her call. But I don't believe it was a racial issue.
Okay. We see throughout this film that Bob Avian, he's in something of a dilemma. On one hand, he's this no-nonsense administrator. He's very, I know what I want, no, 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 no. And on the other hand, we see him going up to the actors during the course of the rehearsals and trying to encourage them. At one point, there is a particular candidate who is asked to re-perform what she did the previous summer, and she can't remember. Mm-hmm. So you have this interesting scenario in which Avian basically is somewhere between these two points, and likewise the audience is too. Did you become aware of this particular temperament of Avian's as you were making the film, and did you want to sort of capture these two despairing disparate points over the course of the film? Or
yeah, I wasn't actually my analysis of him wasn't that. It's actually, now that you say it in hindsight, it's interesting. And I thought Bob was extremely skilled, you know, and he had such an understanding of the show and what Michael's intent was. I mean, Bob Avian, I remember on numerous occasions, Bob saying, you know, what would Michael Bennett do here? What would he want? And, that was very important to Bob. So, in terms of, you know, driving them and having this kind of, not abrasive would be the right word, but...
I don't think he came across as abrasive, but definitely decisive, I would say.
Decisive, yeah. Yeah, I guess at certain points he knew what he wanted, but ultimately he wanted to be nurturing and supportive and inspiring to those trying out for these roles. Mm-hmm. He wanted them, you know, to be at their best, so they would have all the necessary information and see that the auditioners perform in a way that they knew he was seeing the best that they could have for that role.
Yeah, that you juxtapose this narrative against one of the dancers' fathers, who essentially had both of his knees blow out in his 40s. And he describes this moment in which the blood is soaking into his boots right after this performance. But we don't know exactly what he did afterwards, and I'm wondering what he did do. I mean, what do you do when you can't dance anymore, when it's your whole life? And yeah. I never actually got that from the film.
Yeah, we didn't, you know, as a decision we made not to extend on at that point what he did after that. Jacques Dembois, you know, I believe he taught. He's extremely well known here in New York and in the dance community and in the ballet circles. He was a great guy. We were very very honored to be able to interview him, Charlotte Dembois' father. And you know, I don't know. I didn't ask him.
Really?
Yeah, you didn't? I don't believe that we asked him.
Wow. I'm amazed, because it was such a compelling story.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
And maybe we did. I just can't actually recall. It was a couple years ago, and we shot tons of interviews, but he was terrific.
There's one, you know, question I have, because this is a point of controversy in relation to A Chorus Line, and that is Michael Bennett initiating this from a series of conversations initiated at midnight, in which he paid all the dancers $1 to tell their stories. Mm-hmm. And when A Chorus Line was revived, the original dancers who met up there, mm-hmm. They actually got royalties for the previous run, but they did not get royalties for this. And there is some contention among certain Broadway enthusiasts that Bennett, in fact, got more credit than he deserved, because it was just as much about these dancers. And I'm wondering, you know, your film goes out of the way to credit Bennett as this great originator, and it's certainly A Chorus Line could not have happened without him. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering why the film did not explore, you know, the dancers who really their blood and guts were taken for this particular production, and I don't know if the film quite is entirely equitable, particularly in light of this dilemma in terms of them not receiving royalties for the revival.
Yeah, we were hired to, you know, direct and produce the film, and the film we wanted to make, we wanted to celebrate, you know, the creation of the show with the audio tapes that we were using, and include Donna McKechnie, Marvin Hamlisch, Bjork, those dancers that actually were part of the creation of the show and were present in the audio tape session. So we did do that, but I know there are other dancers we didn't include in that, but we wanted that represented, and I felt we did a.
Well, Wayne Cilento, who played Mike, he told the New York Times, "We were the authors of the show, and we should have been paid accordingly." Did you try to track down Wayne to get his side of the story on this?
Yeah, that wasn't... we were aware of that article that came out in the process of the show. I know it was in the New York Times, but that just wasn't what we were focusing on. That, legal dispute or legal...
Yeah.
Whatever was happening, that wasn't what we were hired to examine. I think there was other individuals involved with that, and that wasn't where we came on board to direct a film about the creation of the show, and that we wanted to keep that our focus and really focus on the primary spine of the film was documenting the audition process of the revival.
Okay, but then you have this section of the film that is devoted to Bennett, and so I'm wondering if you're doing a complete documentary, I mean, aren't you obligated to sort of show even this particular side? I mean, I like the film, don't get me wrong, but aren't you obligated to show various sides of the story as well as the story that you're dwelling upon in this film?
I don't think you're obligated. I think as a filmmaker, we come up with the vision of the film that we wanted to tell, and the vision of the what we wanted to tell, that's the movie that's up on screen. Mm-hmm. So if there's an absolute obligation to examine other elements to that, as you reference, that is an option. It's just not what we wanted to do, and so we didn't do it.
Well, Adam, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks so much.
Chatting.
All right, appreciate it. Thanks
great.
A lot.
Thanks.